A past Supreme Court ruling protected private companies from having to provide contraception coverage to employees. Today, the Trump administration issued new rules saying virtually any employer with an objection to birth control can opt out of the currently mandated coverage effective immediately.
Meanwhile, last night at a dinner with military leaders and their spouses, President Trump made some rather cryptic remarks to reporters, telling them it might be, quote, the calm before the storm, though he wouldn't specify what the storm was. Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now, Chad Pergram of Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Abby Phillip of The Washington Post. Hi, Abby.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And let's start with you, Abby, on that employer contraception coverage note that Robin was just talking about. Is this just more of an effort by the White House to sabotage Obamacare?
Well, I think it's actually one of those longstanding things that the Trump administration has been pressured, particularly by conservative groups and religious groups, to do for quite some time. I think it is part of the overall effort to kind of unwind a lot of the rules and regulations associated with the Affordable Care Act. But I think that the deeper issue is making good on a promise to roll back what has been seen on the right as an infringement on religious freedom that some of the Obamacare regulations put in place. So, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services argues that 99% of women are still going to have access to free contraceptive coverage. But this rule is a huge symbolic impact on the Affordable Care Act, and also for conservatives, it's a huge win for them.
Well, Chad, and talk more about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. You have re-upping coming November 1st. Where are we on it?
Well, it's kind of off to the side. About a week ago, they approved a budget or put out a budget framework in the Senate, and they approved that in committee yesterday, which leaves open a very narrow pathway, and it is very narrow, to possibly repeal and replace Obamacare. We heard a couple of weeks ago, and if you didn't know what had happened, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate last week, had decided not to consider this bill proposed by Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, and Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana. They didn't have the votes. This is always the same problem that they seem to have. But if you listen to Lindsey Graham, he said, you know, we're on a path to pass this. Vice President Pence had said, we're getting close. This was at a rally in Alabama for Luther Strange, the now lame duck senator from Alabama. But that's not the case. At some point, they may come back to do this. And the reason it is important to note that they left open this very narrow provision in the budget reconciliation package, this is for tax reform. That budget package really doesn't have as much to do with budgets as it does to avoiding a filibuster in the Senate when it comes to tax reform. They've had that problem with health care. There's no way they're going to get to 60 votes, which is what you need to overcome a filibuster. And possibly, if they can ever get there on health care, you could potentially do health care and tax reform in one fell swoop. Now, that's going to be a long way away, but that is the parliamentary option that is available right now.
Abby, what did President Trump mean by the calm before the storm?
Tell
us. Do we have any idea at this point?
We don't. And I think there's a good possibility that he may have meant absolutely nothing at all by it.
It scared a lot of people, though. So you could hear it in the reporter's voice in the room.
It's pretty alarming. And I think he was very vague. And it didn't help that he was doing it surrounded by all of these, you know, military officers in uniform. I mean, look, the president is typically the kind of person who, when he's around people in the military, he talks about the American might and the use of military force. And it could very well have been an empty threat, or it could have been something that was related to something that maybe we will find out later. But I think a lot of folks in the White House right now don't know. Nobody's rushing to go out there and say, oh, here's what he was referring to. And that's because this president has a penchant for drama, and he definitely did that last night.
Well, Chad, I mean, you know, he's standing there with the military people saying, and he did say, you'll find out, as if there is something. And as Abby just said, the people in the room looked a little shaken, but you wonder how this message is received. Oh, in North Korea, you know, is there a storm coming?
Or Iran.
And speaking of Iran, there's reporting today that President Trump is going to decertify the Iran nuclear deal. It has to be recertified every 90 days, certifying that Iran is abiding by the deal. He is not going to do that, which we understand, tell me if I'm wrong, essentially kicks this to Congress to re-up the sanctions. Where are we on the Iran nuclear deal, Chad?
If there is non-certification by the Trump administration, this puts it into the hands of Capitol Hill. And as one senior source here told me yesterday, they said it's like handing us a grenade and pulling the pin and handing it up to Capitol Hill. And they said, what do you think we're going to do at that point? There's not really a constituency on Capitol Hill for Iran. When they passed the original Iran framework a couple of years ago, there's a provision that says that the leadership in the House and the Senate have a 60-day window. So if we get a week out here and there's non-certification on the Iran deal by the Trump administration, a two-month window begins to run where the leadership can call up a bill which would basically, a very special bill, which would bypass these filibusters in the Senate, by the way, which would basically re-snap in the sanctions that were there before. And people are thinking that's generally what's expected to happen because you don't have any reason why people up here would vote against it. Certainly some Democrats will object to that, people who were supportive of what President Obama did. And it's important to note that Defense Secretary James Mattis told a Senate committee just a couple of days ago that he thought that generally this was working and it was preventing Iran from advancing in its nuclear weapons program.
Well, and it sounds – yeah, go ahead, Abby.
It's also worth noting that one of the main proponents of Trump decertifying the Iran deal, Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas, who was at the White House yesterday, has also kind of indicated that he would not be in a huge rush to pass new sanctions legislation, which sort of raises the question of what he and others who oppose this deal want Congress to do and when. It's very possible that they might not go with any sort of urgency to pass a sanctions bill because that would precipitate a rift and a crisis with our European allies. But if they take the time, what are they taking the time to do? I think to Chad's point, it's a grenade with the pin out, but it's like not clear exactly how long they have to deal with this problem or how long they are willing to take.
Let's talk about what has been surely the top story of the week and the response in Washington, and that would be the shooting in Las Vegas. The head of the National Rifle Association, Wayne LaPierre, went on Fox News last night to clarify why, after years of mass shootings, his organization is now backing a narrow measure to restrict bump stocks, the device that the Las Vegas shooter used to make his rifles fire automatically. Let's listen.
What the NRA has said is we ought to take a look at that, see if it's in compliance with federal law, and it's worthy of additional regulation. That being said, we didn't say ban. We didn't say confiscate.
Chad, what are the politics of this right now? And why do you think that after this mass shooting, the NRA is actually sounding like they may be on board with a change to regulations?
I think folks have to look very carefully at what the NRA said. They said that they are open to types of regulation here. You have members of Congress on both the Republican and certainly on the Democratic side calling for banning of these bump stocks. And people are saying, well, wait a minute, why can't Congress finally move? We had Sandy Hook, we had Aurora, we had Columbine, we had Virginia Tech. Consider this. If Congress didn't act after separate mass shootings, which nearly killed former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who was here at the Capitol twice, including the day after the shooting just this past week, appealing for gun legislation, and nearly killed House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, who's going to throw out the first pitch at the playoff game tonight in Washington between the Chicago Cubs and the Washington Nationals. Why do you think there would be any movement now? And again, this is going to be the other thing. I've talked a couple of times here on other issues about 60 votes. You're going to have 60 votes to move anything through the Senate. And number two, if you have a piece of legislation which deals with bump stocks, you know, they always talk about this as compromise. Well, if Democrats get something on bump stocks, they're going to want more on handguns and they're going to want more potentially on background checks. The Republicans aren't going to go for that. You know, there was this piece of legislation on silencers, which was sidelined a couple of days ago. Republicans are going to demand those things, and that might be the reason why nothing else happens this time, because unless they can say, all right, we'll give you something on silencers, if you guys get something on bump stocks, or we'll give you something on these accessories, if you give us something on open carry across state lines, this is going to be a very complicated situation. There's a reason why Henry Clay said that compromise is negotiated hurt, and both sides would have to give.
Well, the difference, and we only have a little over a minute here, the difference, though, is that this is the first mass shooting in our modern history, in our history, that used these automated rifles. Now, you could say that they were made to be automated from single shot through these kits. And, Abby, we're hearing even from Republican legislators, lawmakers, saying, and it's kind of shameful, but saying, I never heard of a bump stock. I didn't know you could take a single-shot rifle and make it an automatic through this kit, which is legal on the federal level, but illegal. You know, it's legal to buy it, but it's illegal to use it in many states. So is this different?
Well, I think we may have found the one red line here for the NRA and for some of the most vociferous advocates of the Second Amendment. It's a virtually automatic weapon. I think this is one of those things that Republicans will find that it's very easy to agree to ban bump stocks because it's easy to say we want to ban people from being able to convert their conventional weapons into automatic
weapons.
Exactly, into machine guns. It's easy. They can do it, put it aside, and say, we did something, and then move on. I think it's very unlikely that there will be almost anything else done on this issue.
That's Abby Phillip, who is White House reporter for The Washington Post. We've also been speaking with Chad Pergram, Fox News senior producer for Capitol Hill. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
And what a week, once again.
What a week. And we didn't even get to Plainsgate, which is taking on a whole new life.
Some of us are a little addicted to home improvement shows. Ty Pennington, Extreme Makeover Home Edition, we miss you. Networks have grown up around these shows. Think DIY and HGTV, shows that turn rundown homes into high-end luxury residences. Now a new show based in Missouri takes that challenge to a new level. They take old grain bins and moving containers and make them into lovely tiny homes, sometimes complete with granite countertops and decks, even though people tell them, you can't turn that into a house.
We're rewriting the rules of home design across the country.
Perfect fit. Done.
We're making the craziest, wildest, most dangerous, rundown places.
Oh, yeah.
Into the most surprising and luxurious dream homes.
Look at this.
The name of the show, You Can't Turn That Into a House. The hosts are Brothers Timur, the money guy, and Rehan, the dreamer, Nana, and their contractor architect friend, Kyle Davis. Timur, are you there?
Yes.
Rehan?
Yes.
And Kyle?
This is Kyle.
And welcome to all of you. Tomorrow, I'm going to start with you. Building, I mean, this is so Rough Rider. This is so cowboy carpentry. How did you guys come up with this?
You know what? This story started off about 10 years ago, and the three of us were sitting around, and we had an old grain bin and a 100-year-old wooden barn that had been partially collapsed due to a tornado. We live here in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to really take the two and combine them together, and we came up with a design of taking a grain bin and making it into a luxury two-story cabin that we felt people from the city could come out and enjoy the wilderness, where we really wanted to basically connect people to nature in the process of building cabins out in the wilderness.
Well, Rehan, I was going to ask, is this about being green and sustainable and seeing, you know, something not be thrown away, even though it's an old crashed school bus? Is there something
I mean,
of that? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a crashed school bus, I mean, grain silos, tubes, anything and everything.
Whoa! This time, we're reeling in a big one.
Got him!
As we turn this busted semi-trailer into a lakeside bachelor pad.
You think you could cast into the lake from here?
Yeah, there's definitely that aspect. You know, we've all had long discussions about this, and one of the things that we really enjoy is being able to reuse things that would have otherwise been left fallow. Like, if you look across the Midwest, there's literally thousands of old grain silos that just by the progress of, you know, agriculture, they get bigger. And so all these old ones are just left there. And so we looked at them and said, hey, I think we can turn that into a house, and we actually did end up doing it. And what's really nice is, you know, a lot of these are out out in the country, and so you really get to see a great glimpse of rural America.
Well, out the windows of these. I mean, that's the one thing I love. I mean, people would pay millions for some of the views that you get with, you know, a collapsed, you know, whatever it is, an old shed that has the view built in. Things are already there on the properties. Kyle Davis, talk about, you know, the cowboy aspect. I was watching one show. Actually, I think it's the finale, and I'm not going to give too much away. But you guys are all standing on the very tops of ladders, holding up heavy beams while you lower a 300-pound ring over them to form this dome-like roof. I'm hoping there were 50 people below you holding onto your ladders, but it looks dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, it is. It is for sure. But, you know, it's really a different scenario every single time. I guess just don't like following rules and doing it how everyone else does with a full crew taking, you know, months and months on end and
hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'd rather do it with two brothers out in the country, maybe a couple farmers, and get it done in a week.
This is Timur. I think you'll find in the show that there's an aspect of adrenaline junkie in all of us when we're doing these things. There's a little bit of thrill seeking as we're bouncing on top of 30 feet up on these wooden beams.
Yeah, talk about that, Rehan, the high wire act. But seeing something that someone else might see as a piece of junk and seeing another picture in your mind's eye.
Yeah, well, we all got our fingers and toes, so everything's good on that side. But we all kind of look at things differently, I think, in all of these different structures. And you get to really see, when we sit down collaboratively and start spitballing, the potential that an object does have. And I think it's something that I always enjoy because it's breaking something back down. It's almost like being a kid again, right? Like, mm-hmm. Getting to play with Legos and imagining what something could be. And I think that when you're looking at a structure to try to turn it into a house, that's one of the critical things that you have to do is not imagine what it is now, but imagine what it could be.
And what are some of the things?
Gosh, it runs the game.
Dumpster.
Yeah, a dumpster. That was a crazy one.
While Tony connects the fold-up deck to the dumpster, Kyle and I are working on the stairs to the lofted bedroom. Without that loft, we never would have been able to fit all the comforts of a home inside this tiny dumpster.
Nice!
We don't have room for a full staircase, so we're going with a ladder design with alternating treads to maximize our space.
Wait, screw it!
Done.
All right, let's put this in the dumpster. So really it has all the comforts of a nice little apartment, and you can load it up on the back of a truck and drive it down the road if you need to.
Well, back of a dump truck.
Well, a couple questions. First of all, it's a dumpster. Mold, and I'm imagining a smell you can't get out.
I think started thinking that as well, but we cleared out the trash, and then Rehan got in there with a gigantic heavy duty power washer that was the full size of a pickup truck, and just power washed the thing as good as we possibly could, and it really cleaned up pretty nice. In the end, it wasn't a dumpster; it was just a nice metal box to get started building the house.
Well, it is so fabulously country chic as well. Talk about the fences and the doors and the other things that, might be lying around and suddenly they become furniture.
I think one of the greatest aspects of what we do is, and it goes back to this like farmer mentality, or I think you mentioned cowboy construction, it's that you use really what's around you.
Gail really likes music, and I like music a lot too. I play. So what we're going to do today is take this old guitar and turn it into a shelf. Since this is a laminate top, we're using a really fine blade on the jigsaw, so hopefully it gets us a clean edge. Okay. Here's what the inside of a guitar looks like.
Now look, you're talking to someone who spent a little bit of time on the home show wielding a power drill of my own. I mean, these things are so much fun. But I know that very often when the camera turns off, the sink falls through the countertop or the wall collapses that you are holding up. I mean, do these things really hold up?
I must say, I've actually spent the night in the one that we built for my in-laws. I've stayed in there, my wife, my
daughter.
What was
it? What was it?
Two grain bins connected together with a glass breezeway. It's got a shower, hot water. We've cooked dinner in there, so it's fully functional. And I think all of them had people sleep in it at some point already.
Well, as we see in the finale, people are suggesting things to you. What's happening? Are you going to do a second season? This is hard work, too. Ty Pennington, I mentioned, they burned out after a while from traveling the country building a house in a week.
Well, this is Timur. I think one thing is that we have a tremendous amount of fun because when I get to work with my brother and two, Kyle is like almost a third brother to me and Rehan. So it's just a blast for us to go out and do it. There is a certain amount of stress that goes into it. There are deadlines and it's a lot of work. But you know what? In a way, we're kind of living our dream.
Yeah, and this is Rehan coming in. I just want to reiterate what Timur said. It's like these guys are my best friends, so getting out there and swinging hammers with them is just, one, a lot of fun. And then, two, a lot of the clients that we get to work with are just, the great people. And so if it's a long day, you're building something for, a girl that's trying to go to college and wants to have a place of her own, makes you put in an extra hour or two at the end of the day.
Well, there's that family that owned a junkyard, and they wanted you to repurpose an old semi-trailer.
What do you need a house for?
Our son, he's graduating from college in just 9 days, and we'd like to surprise him.
We really don't have the extra money to buy him a nice big house, but maybe a semi-trailer might be kind of cool. And
we actually have a lake over here that is on the other side of the property. He loves to fish, and we're going to put it there so he can enjoy the water.
What kind of budget do we have to work with, guys?
I've set aside $24,000.
Okay. What do you think you need in this house?
He definitely needs a great kitchen to cook healthy meals.
He needs a bachelor pad.
Sound from You Can't Turn That Into a House on the FYI Network. We're talking to Timur Nana, his brother Rehan, and their friend and collaborator, Kyle Davis. You know, guys, I was thinking, we've had so many natural disasters. This is thinking around the world, you know, how to build small housing for people that have experienced disaster or the migrant population. I'd love to see your show go, you know, maybe to Puerto Rico someday, or to see what you can do with things that have been left in the wake of a storm.
Yeah, you know, one of the things we do well is designing in a small space and designing things that can be picked up and lifted and put on a truck. And, you know, unfortunately, the disasters that happened in Puerto Rico and in Texas before that, and we had some people writing to us saying, you know, hey, you know, what can we... Let's work on something. And, you know, we've kicked around the idea of maybe we do make some portable prefab housing that could be shipped to disaster areas. I think that would be a really interesting project and challenge to work on.
That's Kyle Davis. Before him, Rehan and Timur Nana, hosts of the FYI show You Can't Turn That Into a House, to which they say, yes, we can. The season one finale airs this weekend. I saw it already. It's so cool. Go to hereandnow.org for more. Guys, thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much for having
us. Thanks a lot.
There is another tropical storm heading for the U.S., and it could arrive as a hurricane this weekend. There are hurricane warnings along the Gulf Coast from Louisiana to Alabama for Tropical Storm Nate, which has already battered parts of Central America. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. He joins us on Skype. Jeff, what's the state of the storm right now?
Well, first and foremost, Jeremy, I've already been asked this many times, is it going to be as strong or significant as Harvey or Irma? You know, we have those two hurricanes and even Maria fresh in our minds. It's unlikely to be as strong as those storms. But I want to remind anyone listening from Louisiana to the western part of the Florida Panhandle that we should not reference prior storms to try to ascertain what the impacts may be. The concern I have right now, we all see the track, and there is rather high confidence on the track being somewhere near those locations I just mentioned. But what you rarely see, and it's difficult to see from the National Hurricane Center, is the spread in confidence or forecast error as it relates to storm intensity. And there is a concern, and I've seen kind of an undercurrent of concern from meteorologists that conditions do point to the possibility that there is going to be rapid intensification before landfall. And so I think the over-preparedness, if you will, in southeast Louisiana to Alabama is certainly not a bad idea. There is the possibility of this thing being stronger than what's forecast at landfall. And we've seen this season, Jeremy, several storms go under forecast in terms of their strength.
And it is forecast to make landfall as a hurricane at this point, right? But how strong of a hurricane is the question?
Well, we get these data points from the National Hurricane Center in terms of strength, and there's one sitting offshore with winds of 80 miles per hour, one sitting onshore, just onshore, with winds of 70 miles per hour. So who's to say that in between those data points, it might strengthen further right before landfall? So it's most likely the current forecast is for it to be a strong Category 1, borderline Category 2 at landfall.
Now, this is the 14th named storm in the Atlantic this year. This would be the third hurricane to hit the continental U.S. since August. You've said before this is not an unusual frequency, but what do you think now?
It's not unprecedented still in terms of the number of landfalls, but the fact that they've all kind of hit in this general vicinity, and especially that they've hit in the Gulf, or at least near the Gulf of Mexico, is certainly a little bit unusual. It's important to remember that heading into a season, there is some science and some credibility to how active a season may be, but there's very little science to support the idea that we would know ahead of time where hurricanes make landfall. You know, I think this storm will be memorable for a lot of people, but people maybe in New York City or up in the Northeast will be like, what hurricane season? So it changes and varies from season to season in terms of landfall. And we knew kind of going in this would be at least an above average season.
And there's still plenty of time left in the hurricane season, right?
There is. There's still a chance of another system or two developing. As you get into late October and November, the chances of a U.S. landfall go way down, but the hurricane season does not end until November 30th.
Yeah, it was around Halloween that Hurricane Sandy hit in the Northeast, so we've got some time left. Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, thank you.
You're welcome.
The winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize was announced today. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, won the award for its efforts to establish a global ban on nuclear weapons. Here was the announcement this morning.
ICAN has been the leading civil society actor in the endeavor to achieve a prohibition of nuclear weapons under international law.
Jeff Carter is the executive director of Physicians for Social Responsibility, which helped found ICAN 10 years ago. Jeff, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you. I am thrilled to be here, and I'm thrilled to be talking about this topic. It's just been an amazing whirlwind of a morning.
Yeah, well, tell us how it feels to win the Nobel Peace Prize, be part of it.
Well, you know, for us, you know, who've been working on this for so long, it just feels like validation for all the work we've done, especially this past year working on the UN ban treaty and, you know, sometimes feeling like nobody's paying attention, you know, with all the attention going on now with the rhetoric between our country and North Korea in particular, the hopeful message that I think the ban treaty represents has kind of got lost in the shuffle. The goal of ICAN is actually quite simple. It's the total elimination of nuclear weapons. We know that that is a lofty goal, but we believe it's an achievable goal. And what's really significant about the ban treaty is that for the first time, the non-nuclear states around the world are standing up and saying, this is not acceptable. We will not be held hostage to these weapons any longer. We don't expect the nuclear states to be signing the treaty anytime soon, but this really puts pressure on them. And the most important thing is that it begins to stigmatize these weapons even further. History has shown us that that has been the way to eliminate weapons of mass destruction.
At the same time, it does appear like in North Korea, we're getting closer to having another nuclear power with even more capability than before.
Yes, but remember why North Korea is pursuing that capability. The North Koreans feel under threat by the United States, and their leader has looked around the world and seen what has happened to other leaders that have come into conflict with the United States. They've been removed and sometimes killed, and I believe that their response, while I certainly don't agree with it and it's certainly dangerous, it's not irrational. And I think what we've got to do is, while we are working on stigmatizing the use of these weapons, we really need to get back to diplomatic discussions with the North Koreans to convince them to go in a different direction.
Not 24 hours before the announcement of the Nobel Peace Prize, there was another report that said that President Trump may pull the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, which is in place to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. What do you think about that?
I think that would be a catastrophe for the United States and for the world. We at PSR worked very hard with others in the anti-nuclear movement to support the Iran deal. It represents years of work to get that deal done. If we walk away from it, it actually puts Iran in a stronger position. It makes them look like the party that's been harmed because we're the one walking out. And it really makes it difficult for us to go forward with negotiations with North Korea because our credibility as someone you can trust when you're sitting down to make a deal is going to be in question.
That's Jeff Carter, who's executive director of Physicians for Social Responsibility, a group that helped found the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize today. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, all week we've been talking about the Nobel Prizes as they've been announced. And for the first few days, when the prizes were for science, there were a lot of Americans among the winners. 3 in medicine, 3 in physics, and 1 in chemistry. Joining us now is Kei Koizumi, who's a visiting scholar in science policy at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Kei Koizumi, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And what does it say to you that so many of the Nobel winners this year, as in years past, are American?
It's a great week for American science. I mean, the reason that we have so many Americans as Nobel Prize winners, again, is because over the past 5-6 decades, America's invested in them, invested in their science, and invested in the research that's needed to make the breakthroughs that they're being honored for this week. So it's an important legacy of how America has supported science over the years. But it's also a little bit of a warning sign in that if we're going to win future Nobel Prizes, we need to be making investments today in fundamental science that is going to lead to the discoveries that will change our world for the next few years.
Which brings us to Washington, where President Trump's budget is calling for big cuts to science funding.
That's right. So this administration, in its budget proposal that it released in May, has proposed very steep, unprecedentedly steep cuts to science funding in federal agencies like the National Institutes of Health, like the National Science Foundation and the Department of Energy, and so many others. So the scientific community is very worried, and I think we all should be worried because scientific research takes a long time. Many of these Nobel Prize winners this week are being honored for, you know, discoveries that they started making 40 years ago.
Right.
With the Gravitational Wave Observatory, for example, I mean, it took 40 years of continuous effort supported by the National Science Foundation to get to this discovery that's really revolutionized our understanding of our place in the universe. And it's going to take that kind of continued, sustained support to make the discoveries of the future.
What if a member of Congress who is in favor of these cuts makes the case that private money should be used for this scientific research? Is that reasonable or no?
I think it's not reasonable to expect private companies to invest in long-term, basic, blue-sky research. Companies do invest a lot in research and development in the United States. They invest in applied research or development that will bring the discoveries that come out of our labs to the marketplace in the form of new products and services and technologies. But it's in no company's interest to make investments in basic chemistry, basic biology, because the returns are too far away and they're too diffuse for a company to capture. That's why, over the past 7 decades, the federal government has invested in basic research, and companies have invested down the road in research and development to take advantage of the discoveries that come out of the basic research the federal government supports.
If the cuts are made and then another administration comes in a matter of years and restores the funding, does that fix the problems that come from the cuts, or is it too late at that point?
I think it's too late. I mean, if you just think about asking, well, your child, you have to stop fourth grade. 4 years later, well, maybe you can go back to fourth grade. I mean, that's not realistic. You're going to destroy, you know, your child's education. Same with research projects. I mean, if you take a look at any of these discoveries, it took year after year of continuous sustained funding by research agencies to keep the investigators on track, to keep the graduate students working on a project, to build the instruments that were needed to make those discoveries. If you had interrupted those investments, they would not have happened. So, I mean, it's important for, I think, people to understand that, as with education, scientific research takes year after year of continuous sustained effort. Traditionally, the federal government has long supported those year-by-year patient efforts. And that's why we are the scientific powerhouse that we are today. And that's why we're seeing so many Nobel Prize winners who are Americans in the sciences.
So why do you think the Trump administration wants to cut science funding?
I don't pretend to know why. Well, of course, they state that this is a time when the government has to restrain its spending. And I understand where that's coming from. I just think that it's very short-sighted to make these spending cuts that may look good on paper for this year, but they're going to have these tremendous long-term impacts. America's future is going to look less bright if we make these cuts today.
That's Kei Koizumi, who is a visiting scholar in science policy at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ever wonder what happens after you recycle your plastic milk jugs, paper, and soda cans? Do you ever wonder if you're doing it right? For instance, certain plastics that I can recycle in my city, I can't recycle across the country in L.A. Emily Seiner of member station WPLN in Nashville got to wondering about all this, so she decided to dive into how recycling works in her city and learned a universal lesson about what happens if you're not careful about what you toss in the bin.
I'm at Mark McCaw's house, simply to rifle through his recycling bin.
Here's all sorts of sparkling water cans. And so I've got little, like, Amazon boxes. And then I think the final thing that we have is bottles.
He pulls out a container filled with empty glass.
We've got a good bottle of, I think that was sangria.
McCaw is a hardcore recycler, so much so that he and his wife don't buy certain things at the grocery store because of the container they're in. Like, they'll buy eggs in cardboard cartons, but not styrofoam, because you can't put styrofoam in Nashville's recycling.
What is your reaction when you go over to, like, friends' houses and you clearly have something that should be recyclable, like a glass bottle, and they just tell you to throw it away?
I am very guilty of walking out with anything that I use at somebody else's house or office. If my body has touched it, I'm going to do everything I can do to recycle it.
McCaw's neighborhood doesn't have curbside pickup, and he's not exactly sure what happens after he takes his carefully sorted recycling to a drop-off site. There, all sorts of rules are posted. No scrap metal, nothing soiled with food, no plastic bags.
What happens? Does that mess things up?
The exact rules of what you can and can't recycle in your city-run program are probably slightly different than Nashville's. But the answer is the same. If you recycle incorrectly, you are messing things up. To understand why, I went to Nashville's main recycling facility, owned by Waste Management. In one room, recycling trucks dump their loads onto a giant dune of stuff. Up close, I see a yellow Purity Dairy milk jug, an empty 2-liter of Pepsi, a box that once held Nature Valley granola bars. All this material runs through a series of conveyor belts and machines, and workers stand by to physically pull out stuff. It's here that cardboard gets separated from paper, from the plastics, from aluminum.
We like to say that we unscramble the omelet.
That's Paul Farley, the guy who runs this center. He stands with me as a recycling truck pulls up to the mountain of junk and tips out its load.
Oh!
Wrong!
Not good.
Yeah, that's glass. Glass gets recycled separately in Nashville because this facility can't handle it. It wears down the equipment and shards get stuck in other materials. Turns out more and more cities are pushing for separate glass recycling because of these problems. But what's even more universally reviled among recycling facilities are plastic bags, of which I see many in this pile.
What about, like, that bag of LaCroix
That right container? There, they can see it. It's tied. You'll see on the sort line. They don't have time to go up there and be breaking every bag open. So good chance it might wind up in the trash.
Sorters pull plastic bags off the conveyor belt when they notice them because the sorting machines have a lot of spinning parts. Bags twist around them and get stuck.
We have to physically get in the equipment and cut all those bags out.
How often?
We do it minimum once at lunch and then at the end of the day. Sometimes we have to do it more.
Okay, so bags equal bad news. What about food? Why is that so bad?
Let's say you had a gallon of milk and you put it in your recycling bin and the truck dumps. It's not just going to contaminate your recyclables. It's going to contaminate a lot more in that truck.
What about pizza boxes?
Pizza boxes these days, they come with a liner in the bottom. I tell people, I want the box, I don't want the pizza. Eat the pizza, give me the box.
But what about the feeling that so many people have when they're standing next to the trash can with an empty container and they ask themselves, should I be recycling this? To answer, Farley says, people need to realize that what you can throw in most city recycling bins is actually pretty limited. Paper products, metal and aluminum, hard plastics.
My big key is focus on the things that can be recycled and let's get that right. And it's not really that hard to follow.
Our final stop in the recycling facility is a building with a giant baler. By this point, everything has been separated by material, bundled up into neat bales and tied with wire.
There's some cardboard that we baled. There's some mixed paper.
Is that a bale of plastic bottles?
Yeah. And then from here, we ship by rail car or tractor trailer, go to different mills all around the southeast.
It's inside these mills that the recycling actually happens. They turn your paper into new cardboard, they turn plastic into carpet, and aluminum into new aluminum cans. So if you put something in your recycling bin that the mills don't want, it's just mucking up the process. One mill I talked to rejects entire 2,000-pound bales every day because they have too much contamination. The key is you still can recycle those other things. You can return your plastic bags to the local grocery store, which sends them off to be recycled. You can compost your food waste. That turns into dirt. Again, Paul Farley.
If you look, there's really a home for just about everything.
That home just isn't always your city recycling bin. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Siner in Nashville.
And at least it's no longer that home, you know, just stuck in, you know, landfills. I can't believe we used to do that. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. By the way, next week we're going to be talking with Anthony Bourdain, who's involved in a new documentary about how much food we waste.
And he'll, of course, be very civil and never use any dirty words.
Swear words.
Yes.
It's Here and Now.